All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hello and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry. I was a CW-2 helicopter pilot in Vietnam in 1969 in the United States Army. I want to welcome you to our program today. We're going to be talking about D-Day, which is coming up on its 75th anniversary later this week. And we've got a couple of things that I think you'll find very interesting. Number one is we're going to be talking to Ben Mankiewicz from Turner Classic Movies. He's going to be joining us in a little bit. They're showing 75 movies under the heading of Never Surrender, World War II and Movies. They're going to show 75 films honoring the 75th anniversary of D-Day. In the second half of the program, we're going to be talking with one of the last survivors of the assault on Pont-au-Hoc during the D-Day invasion of France back on June 6, 1944. But to start off the program, we're going to have our resident political and military expert on the program, and that is Dr. Rebecca Grant. And she's a national security analyst based in Washington, D.C., and of course she's a frequent guest here on Veterans Radio, and this week she's going to catch us up on what's going on militarily and politically around the world. So we're going to take a real quick break for a word from our sponsor, Legal Help for Veterans, come back, and we will have Dr. Grant here listening to you. So don't go away. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back to Veterans Radio, and today's program we're going to be talking a lot about D-Day, but before we get to D-Day, we have our own special guest and expert in what's going on in the world of the military and the Air Force and everything else, Dr. Rebecca Grant. So, Dr. Grant, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Delighted to be back on Veterans Radio.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the program because you give us such insight as to what really seems to be going on in the world. So let's start right off. We just heard that the president was in Japan and our good friends in North Korea decided that they were going to test fire a couple more of their little missiles. So what do we make of that?
Well, point one, it's spring and Kim Jong-un sure likes to exercise those military forces during springtime. So, Dale, well, I was pretty sorry to see a couple of the tests go on, but it's important to put them in context. First of all, they weren't intercontinental or even long-range ballistic missiles. What we believe that Kim launched was an old variant of a Russian missile called the Iskander. And the Iskander has a couple new variants that are pretty nasty, which the Russians themselves have deployed. But we don't believe that North Korea has that missile. So I see this happening as a sign that Kim is still very frustrated and impatient. As we know, the Hanoi summit ended with Trump walking out. Mm-hmm. And that was because Kim wanted some immediate sanctions relief. Trump was unwilling to do that, which was good. And, you know, Trump also has to take into account our allies. So Kim is firing off some missiles to show his frustration, but they're very old, short-range missiles. So these aren't the types that he was testing back in the period from about 2013 to 2017.
Okay, so you don't think he was trying to be provocative at all? He was just trying to make a point?
I think he was trying to make a point, and the one good thing here still is that he has not tested any of the newer intercontinental missiles. Dale, he was about a dozen test shots short of really developing a reliable intercontinental capability that could do a realistic trajectory back into the atmosphere and do weapon separation. And that's good. We didn't want him to complete that test regime. So as long as he doesn't complete it, we are still quite a bit safer. And that's why you see Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, saying that there really has been a noticeable reduction in tensions on the Korean Peninsula. So bad of him to do some launches, but he's still staying just barely within the letter of his agreement with President Trump not to launch and test more missiles or nuclear weapons.
Okay, and so, well, while we're in Asia, why don't we take a little bit of a look at China, because they seem to be getting a little bit more aggressive in their flotillas that are sailing around the Pacific Ocean and South China Sea.
What a change with China month to month to month, of course, with the backdrop of a really active trade war going on. Now, don't forget, this trade war started back in the spring of 2018. Trump has been very methodical He increased tariffs in a few small areas and then expanded it up to the point we're at today. The Chinese are excellent businessmen. They are very tough negotiators. I think this reset of trade was long overdue, but I don't expect to see it solved real soon. The other thing that's really worrying out in China is that they are much more active with their activities down in the South China Sea and also their activities up around Japan. You know, Xi Jinping promised back in 2016 that he would not put military forces on those tiny little reefs down in the South China Sea. Mm-hmm. But he's violated that promise. They went ahead and built a 10,000-foot runway, dredged and sandbagged and reclaimed some little reefs to make them just above the surface of the ocean. They have petroleum storage. They have electronic warfare. They have rotated bombers and fighters in and out of these little bases. Now, they don't keep a big force there permanently, but basically what he's done is say, hey, we are ready to use these little island features in the South China Seas anytime. And he is really, really pushing back with the active military forces. We see reports of continued development of stealth aircraft by the Chinese and just every sign that China's military is still on the rise.
Well, it's a huge military, isn't it? I mean, how many active personnel do they have that you can put a number on?
Yeah, it's big. It's a little deceptive, though, because they actually, about 15 years ago, made some pretty big cutbacks in their land forces. But they had decided that the wars of the future would involve information and cyberspace and navy and air. But I tell you where they are really expanding, and that is in space. They have over 250 satellites active. Now, some of those are communication satellites, but they all represent a really growing capability of China to operate in space. And we're also told by our Defense Intelligence Agency that China might have a laser weapon ready by about 2020. This would be a ground-based laser somewhere deep in China that could point upward and use a laser to knock out one of our satellites. Bad stuff. So, yes. You know, with China, you have to watch every domain. Air, sea, land, cyberspace, and space as well.
That's very Star Warish.
It is, and yet it's the sort of thing we can do now. It's all been a matter of increasing the power through these big fiber optic lasers, and mm-hmm. if they can do that. Of course, as it turns out, you know, spacecraft are pretty vulnerable. Satellites are vulnerable. You can bump them into each other, and our U.S. Space Command is really investing in tracking what goes on orbit so they can look and see who's coming behind them and track the space debris and also see what actors like China and Russia and others are doing up there in low Earth orbit.
Well, you would think so with all of the hardware that has been thrown up into, you know, into orbital space up there, you know, since the 1950s, that there's got to be collisions, it seems like, probably on a fairly regular basis.
It's been a huge increase. And so what they call space situational awareness, which is basically like directing rush hour traffic up in mm-hmm. space, is a top priority now. And, you know, did you know that the average American uses space 36 times a day? So anytime you navigate with your phone or do a banking transaction mm-hmm. or rely on other information sources, you're probably using a space asset to get that done. But that's a stunning number, 36 times per day. And it shows why the commons of space are as important to our daily life as the oceans once were and still are. So that's just something that China is trying to challenge, not only our ability to use space, but to sort of hold that threat over us to say, hey, if it comes to a military conflict, you're going to have to watch out for your space assets because those might be fair game if we have a disagreement.
That's true. Well, in that regard, where do you think that the space military organization is going now? Has that started working on that, or is it still in development?
Yeah, that's still very, very much in work. One thing we expect is to have a four-star general nominated to lead a unified space command. We had one prior to 9/11, and they want to bring that back. That's a great move. Mm-hmm. The rest, it's up to Capitol Hill. The defense budget is up there now, with the House and the Senate committees looking it over. They will have to decide whether to fund a distinct space department that will stay within the Department of the Air Force but start that slow process of turning into a distinct sixth branch of the military. Right now, the Pentagon has proposed doing that. President Trump is in favor. So it's up to the legislators in the House and in the Senate to decide if they want to do that and fund it going forward.
It'll be interesting, that's for sure, if they decide to do that.
Very, very interesting. And one thing I like about it is that it puts some attention on space and the fact that we need to improve our capabilities for launch, have more resiliency in our satellites. And I think it's got that warfighting focus on space. So that part of it I like, however the organization shakes out in the end.
Okay. Let's go halfway around the world to Iran and see what's going on over there. So what's happening in Iran right now, Dr. McGrann?
Halfway around the world, that's right. And can you believe, Dale, it's been 40 years since the revolution and the taking of the hostages. So 40 very tough years with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Latest development is the Pentagon requested and President Trump approved an increase in forces in the region. It's going to be about 1,000 to 1,500 people. And they are exactly the men and women you would expect. We'll see a little bit more air presence, more force protection for the bases that are on the ground. Remember, we have troops all over the region, 5,000 in Iraq, troops in Syria still, and of course in many other bases throughout the Gulf. And an increase in surveillance, plus some increase in naval capability. And that all happened because there were very specific indications back in the early May timeframe that Iran was about to start another campaign of using its proxies to do terrorist acts against a variety of targets, and that those could include U.S. forces and maybe even U.S. diplomats in the region. It was not one specific event, but it was about launching a new campaign. Reason for that, it has been a year since President Trump exited from the Iran deal, and a whole bunch of waivers about Iran's oil sales and other economic matters had expired at the beginning of May. That has the regime up in arms in Iran, and it was a concern that they might use proxy military forces to retaliate.
Well, what about, you know, everybody, it seems like in that part of the world, always seems to want us to come running in and, you know, and rescue them. What about the other countries that are surrounding Iran? Do you think that that might be getting a little bit more dicey for them, too?
Well, they are pretty worried as well. And, you know, one big concern, of course, is Iraq, which shares a long border with Iran. We often see weapons coming over to Shiite militia in Iraq. They are Iranian-made weapons. Come down a little bit further, and you see Iran and Saudi Arabia have been in a mini-Cold War for quite some time at this point. The rebellion in Yemen was fueled and started in many ways by Iranian-backed forces. That's still going on. Most of our Gulf allies, like the UAE and Qatar and others, are very close within range of Iranians. All calm down as well. And, of course, Iran is very fond of saying that they will threaten Israel. So, really, Iran is just an enormous threat across the region with their military forces. And one thing that our military has been pretty clear about is saying, hey, you've got to keep your proxies under control. You've got to keep Hezbollah under control. You know, if we see an attack by Hezbollah forces, we're going to treat that as an attack by Iran. So I think the deterrence is working. The Ayatollah Khamenei came out a couple weeks ago and said he does not want war. President Trump said the same thing. And our commander there, General McKenzie, who's a Marine, was very clear that they're not seeking war. But McKenzie also said, hey, if you test us, you're going to meet our full, firm response. So Iran, don't try it. But you know the Iranians, they're really prone to miscalculate, and they're willing to try anything. They really are kind of craving the ability to develop a nuclear weapon so they can continue their mischief in the region. So they need a really firm response, and that's what we've seen. An aircraft carrier there, they do go there pretty regularly. Four B-52s deployed, and I'm telling you, four is not the usual number. Usually you can signal with one or two, but for Iran, four B-52s to provide that signal.
That sends a pretty big message. Yeah, that does send a
big message. Yes.
All right, so calm down, right? Stop. Stop what you're doing. We need to get things to be able to calm down there in that whole area of the world. And it seems like that so many different parts of the world are always in chaos and turmoil on a fairly regular basis.
So many, it's true. And I tell you, though, one that has made some real strides, and it really relates to D-Day, of course, and that is NATO. NATO actually has come out with a defense strategy for the first time in decades. And this strategy is about countering Russia. And they have a strategy now to put together 30 battalions and 30 squadrons within 30 days if they need to push back against any Russian aggression. And that's a great legacy. You know, Eisenhower was the first commander of NATO back in 1950 when the alliance was formed. And I think he would be proud to see the strength and size of that alliance today, and that they're working on a strategy to face down and deter threats in the region.
Well, it is, and it's great that they've been able to continue, you know, working together, considering all of the factions that are involved, not just in NATO, but in, you know, all the other issues that are occurring around the world, that they are able to stay together and actually come up with a plan. So hopefully that plan will work as a good deterrent.
That's right. Deterrence is still the aim, and NATO is so much bigger, 29 members, looking to go to 30 pretty soon. And states like Finland that aren't members are close cooperative friends of NATO at this point. So it's all about keeping any Russian aggression bottled up and about all the benefits of mutual defense. So working pretty well on this anniversary.
Okay. Well, that's all I wanted to know. We are going to be talking, as I mentioned later on in the program, about D-Day and some of the events that are occurring. I was telling my partner here that I was trying to get a hold of experts on D-Day, and they're all in France. for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. So I went back into our archives to play a little bit later an interview we did with a gentleman who was on D-Day and climbed up onto Hawk. And it's a great, amazing story that I think our listeners are going to be really excited to listen to. So as usual, my resident expert, Dr. Grant, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio and keeping our audience up on what's happening in the world.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, and we'll be talking to you again soon. Thanks again, Dr. Rebecca Grant. In honor of this year's 75th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Normandy, Turner Classic Movies is going to air 24 hours of World War II films every Thursday in June. Never Surrender, World War II in the Movies, begins on June 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day itself. Primetime programming will include introductions by our guest today, Ben Mankiewicz, joined by other expert co-hosts each week and shot on location at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans. I want to welcome Ben Mankiewicz to Veterans Radio. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me, Dale. I really appreciate it.
Well, as a big fan of Turner Classic Movies, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about this Never Surrender World War II in the movie. So tell us all about what's going on at Turner Classic Movies.
Well, so we started in May, and it's going through June every Thursday. It covers nine Thursdays. And I think we have 27 hosted movies where I sit down with a guest during prime time. See on June 6th. Overall, 75 movies to celebrate the 75th anniversary of D-Day. All World War II movies. But as when we get into June, for example, on the 75th anniversary itself with D-Day, June 6th, we'll have exactly the movie you'd expect us to start with. We'll have The Longest Day, which that's really my favorite night of all these because it contrasts so nicely with the movie that we have next, Overlord. You know, a Longest Day is 3 hours long. It's really almost a documentary style depiction of the landings at Normandy. And then Overlord is this short 80-minute film from a British film from a director, Cooper, about one soldier from the moment of his call up, and he lives in a little country village. His call up, the difficulty he has going through training, taking him through the night of June 5th and into the morning of June 6th, and the landing itself is just one very personal story, and I think it really contrasts nicely with the vastness of D-Day.
Well, I think it's really interesting to me, you know, growing up as I did in the 50s and in the 60s and the influence that many of these movies had on me, you know, as you say, you know, Never Surrender, Never Give Up. The selection of movies is just great. I was looking at the whole list of them, and I caught my own personal favorite is Best Years of Our Lives, which was on last week. And I just think they're such a great way for us, you know, for American people, from people all over the world to understand this terrific and catastrophic event that occurred during World War II. And it's such a learning experience, I think, for everybody. And I want to thank Turner Classic Movies for showing these amazing films.
Well, thanks. Yeah, and I think, like many people, I agree on best years of our lives. Hard to hard to argue with best years of our lives. It you know, and that's a good example because you know, I mentioned that you know, on June 6th that we'll have the long stay, we'll have Overlord. We also have you know, the failure of Operation Market Garden that night in a bridge too far. Also on June 6th after the longest day in Overlord. But as you see from you know, a film like Best Years of Our Lives, we also and throughout May we sort of vigorously attacked what was happening on the home front. You know, because you know what World War II meant, the importance, the lasting legacy of World War II. A big part of that is not, of course, just the fighting. It is precisely what happened on the home front. And you know, we had that same night we had you know, Hail the Conquering Hero, mm-hmm. which was a, you know, Preston Sturges comedy from 1944. About hero worship, you know, sort of a risky movie put in American movie theaters right in the middle of the war.
Right.
But you know, we've had Mrs. Miniver. We have had a number of films that have demonstrated the power and intense resolve that the British showed during the war. Mm-hmm. And all of these movies, all these hosted interviews, which you'll see on June 6th, and then the 13th, and the 20th, and the 27th, they're all shot at the National World War II Museum in New Orleans with expert historians there, including senior historian Rob Citino and the founding director and co-founder of the museum, Nick Muller. So, you know, the idea was to give the full, to immerse the viewer as much as we can in the same sort of immersive experience that you get when you're at the museum. And it's an intense experience, the museum. But you learn very quickly that, you know, as hard as things were on Americans during the war, my dad fought, and my mom, you know, remembered, they were very poor, and they certainly remembered the sacrifices that even they made during the war when they were already sacrificing before during the Depression. But it's critical to remember that, you know, we, of course, comparatively to our allies and to our enemies, had it easy. You know, I mean, Britain was under the Blitz regularly, living with the daily thought, especially in London that and other industrial cities, that, you know, this could be this could be the day you died every day. There was a good chance you were going to die or be seriously injured or lose a friend or see your home destroyed. You know, the numbers are just staggering of what the regular everyday working people went through during the war. And thank God in the end, as we know, there's some clarity here. In this case, the good guys won, which is nice.
Well,
nice to have clarity.
Yes, obviously. One of the reasons I was really interested in talking with you is I just did an interview with Robert Mattson, with his book about Audrey Hepburn. And mm-hmm. I had also done one with him about Jimmy Stewart. And now I'm just reading the one about Carol Lombard. And so the events that were occurring and the way that Hollywood got behind, quote, the war effort, I thought was really just an amazing story to me. And looking at all of the actors and actresses that were involved in World War II, not just fighting in the war, but, you know, with the canteens and the fundraising and the bond sales and everything, I'm really amazed at how the country became so united. I mean, obviously, we had a common cause there, just the way that that Hollywood stepped
up. Yeah, it is a reminder that if the cause is righteous, come together. And I do think that there is something, you know, World War II was awful. And as we just, you know, recounted the number of people who lost their lives during the war, women, children, mm-hmm. innocents is staggering. But it did have the benefit of showing what we are capable of as a country under sort of really visionary leadership to sort of come together and get the right thing done. And I the fact, you know, that you mentioned, you know, two of those biographies that you've read about, you know, Audrey Hepburn, you know, grew up in occupied Holland during the war, mm-hmm. you know, basically the same age as Anne Frank. She thinks didn't live far from her. She thinks there's a chance she likely had seen her. And Carol Lombard, who, you know, can certainly be claimed as a casualty of war. You know, she was doing good when she lost her life.
Right. And the story of Jimmy Stewart, it's well, he's an island line anyway, but yes, that's
right.
Beside
Stewart, right. Of course. Stewart, I think Stewart is, but I mean, I don't want to, Stewart is more clear, obviously, because he, you know, this was a gigantic celebrity who, you know, I mean, already made Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, already mm-hmm. won an Academy Award for the Philadelphia Story. And certainly he could have had a much safer job during the war. And instead, as a bomber pilot, he takes on one of the most dangerous jobs. That story's known. I just mean that, you know, the war had a profound, and Audrey Hepburn lived through it. Carol Lombard died. You know, you're correct. Hollywood really sacrificed.
Right. Yeah. And I think that one of the things I did want to mention before I let you go is how movies helped the civilian population understand, although Hollywood style in many cases, exactly what these men and women were going through during World War II. And I think it kept the morale higher than without the movies, probably.
Oh, I don't think there's any question. And every historian at the World War II Museum would tell you the same thing, that you know, even movies like Sands of Iwo Jima, and Seth Paradin is one of the historians that he takes us through a number of movies set in the Pacific. That, you know, this was a way for Americans to get some understanding of what was being sacrificed and what was at risk there, and what those boys were up against.
Right. We're talking here on Veterans Radio with Ben Mankiewicz, who is a host of the Never Surrender World War II in the Movies, which is beginning on June 6th, which is the 75th anniversary of D-Day itself. We're talking about some of these great films. Ben, I want to thank you very, very much for being on Veterans Radio and taking the time out of your obviously busy day coming up to the Never Surrender World War II at the Movies program that's going to begin on June 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day itself. I strongly recommend everybody to tune in to Turner Classic Movies. For those in our veteran audience, check out these movies. I think you're going to really enjoy them, and I think you're going to learn a whole lot about that generation, which is so important.
Thanks. It was a pleasure to talk to you. Anytime.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And here we are on Veterans Radio, coming up on the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And I wanted to let you know that, as I mentioned in another program, was that all of our guests are in France to celebrate the 75th anniversary of D-Day. And so we went back in our archive and pulled up a program that have two parts. And one is, I think, is really important, and that is with Brigadier General William Leszczynski, who is the executive director of the American Battle Monuments Commission. And we all know that there are some just beautiful and thankfully, many, many cemeteries across Europe as a result of World War II and World War I, which he will get into. And then a little bit later on, we actually have he was at the time the last survivor of the assault on Pontiac, which occurred on 6 June 1944, and that is Len Lamel. And Len recently, unfortunately, passed away in March of 2011. But we thought that this interview that we did with both of these people would be very interesting to you. So sit back and enjoy our tribute to the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
All right. And going into our next segment, we're going to be talking with our next guest, Brigadier General William Leszczynski. And you are in charge of the American Battle Monuments Commission. Is that correct, sir?
Well, actually, I'm not in charge of it. I'm the Executive Director and Chief Operating Officer for the American Battle Monuments Commission.
Well, you're not the big cheese, but you're pretty close.
I'm just a small cog in the whole mix.
Okay, well, we welcome you to Veterans Radio, General, and it's a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm really interested in finding out more about what the mission of the commission is.
Well, I'll tell you that the American Battle Monuments Commission is a small independent agency within the executive branch of the federal government, and we've got less than 400 people worldwide. Of course, the majority of our people, as you'd expect, a host nation personnel. And the commission was established on March 4th, 1923, at the initiative of then-General of the Army's John J. Pershing, mm-hmm. to commemorate the services, sacrifice, and achievements of the United States Armed Forces, where they've served since 6 April 17. General Pershing was the commission's first chairman, and he held that position until his death in 1948. And every single day we attempt to live up to what he wanted us to do, and that's never let people forget the sacrifices that the people who came before us made in our behalf.
And so this commission began during World War One.
Well, actually,
as a result of World War One,
in 1923, and again at the initiative of General of the Army Pershing to to commemorate the services, sacrifices, and achievements of the U.S. Armed Forces, where they served since 6 April 1917, which was the date that the United States entered into World War One.
All right, and the responsibilities of the commission are what?
Well, I think the bottom line, if you want to look for what we do, we run the 24 military cemeteries that are located overseas and the 25 memorials, monuments, and markers in 15 different countries worldwide. Now, out of those, 8 are World War One cemeteries, and 14 of those are World War Two cemeteries, and we also have 2 others, one located in Mexico City and in Corozal, Panama. We also have 25 memorials, monuments, and markers, as I said, in 15 different countries, and 15 of those are World War One standalone monuments, memorials, and markers, and the rest of them, 10, are from World War Two, and they are equally impressive as are our cemeteries.
Bill, this is Bob Gould here. How are you?
Hi, Bob. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. Corozal American Cemetery in Panama. Now, what does that, what part of hostilities was that a part of?
Well, I think Corozal, along with Mexico City, is a little bit different, and not many people know much about Corozal, but the bottom line, it's located in Corozal in the Republic of Panama, which is approximately 3 miles north of Panama City itself. And right now we've got over 5,000 identified known dead that are buried there, and they consist of American servicemen and women and workers who were associated with the construction and the maintenance of the Panama Canal. And as part of an agreement with the Republic of Panama, American Battle Monuments Commission assumed responsibility for the care and maintenance of the cemetery in perpetuity on 1 October 1979. So that's how we became responsible for Corozal American Cemetery.
Of the cemeteries that are in France, since we're going to be talking about Normandy with Len Lamel shortly,
yeah,
are those cemeteries owned by France, or is it land that has been deeded to the United States, or how does that work?
Well, the land has been, for all our cemeteries, have been given to us in perpetuity for the burial of our war dead. So many people are somewhat confused, and they think that the land has been given to us outright, much in the same status as our embassies overseas. But that's incorrect. The land, again, has been given to us by the nations in perpetuity for the burial of our war dead.
Okay. So we have cemeteries in France and throughout Europe, probably.
That's correct. The majority of our cemeteries are located on the east side of the Atlantic Ocean. We have 2 of them in the UK. We have 1 in Luxembourg. We have 3 in Belgium. We have 1 in Netherlands. We have 2 in Italy. We have 1 in Tunisia. And we have 11 in France. And if I did my addition right, that should add up to about 21 of them, which are located on the far side of the Atlantic Ocean.
And
all of them are absolutely breathtaking. They're meticulously maintained, and they certainly are a fitting tribute to the sacrifices of our war dead.
They certainly are spectacular, and I would encourage our listeners, if you've never been to Normandy or any of the national cemeteries, is that you can go to the website. It's called abmc.gov, and there's a great video on there that kind of gives you a visual tour of many of the cemeteries and many of your monuments.
I also noticed that when I went to the website today, that there was a feature that you were able to locate someone and tell the site and actually get a map to there.
Yeah, that's correct. If you want to do some kind of investigation, for example, if you have a friend or relative, a next of kin who's buried in one of our cemeteries, if you go to our website, you can just follow right along with the prompts, and the website will be able to tell you if the individual is in fact interred in our cemeteries and which one that person where the remains are.
We are talking right now with Brigadier General Bill Lisinski of the American Battle Monuments Commission, and we've been talking about, Bob just asked a question just before we broke off, about how you can locate a family member or any particular individual, if you, by just going to the American Battle Monuments Commission's website, which I'll give you again here, is abmc.gov. Is that correct, General?
That's correct, www.abmc.gov, and that'll get you right where you need to be.
I think that's with all this technology out there, it's just amazing what you can find now, and you don't have to, you know, you can find anybody if you need to. I think that's terrific.
General Lisinski, are you still taking burials at any of the sites there in Europe?
Well, the our cemeteries that are in Europe, our World War I and our World War II cemeteries, are all closed. However, if the remains remains should be discovered, either from World War I or World War II, the next of kin would have the option of interring their loved one in one of our cemeteries overseas, or bringing the remains back to the United States. So that would be determined by the next of kin, just like it was after World War I and World War II.
Okay. I'd like to move on right now. I wanted to bring on our next guest, and General, I ask you to stay on the line with us because I think you might be able to ask some pertinent questions as we go. And we're going to be joined here in just a second by Len Lamel, who is a survivor of Normandy. He climbed up the cliffs of Pointe du Hoc, blew up artillery, all kinds of things. And I wanted to just give you a little background on our guest. Len, or sometimes better known as Bud, graduated from Point Pleasant High School in 1937, Point Pleasant, New Jersey. Mr. Lamel, I want to welcome you very much to Veterans Radio. I want you to tell us a little bit about your experience on that morning of D-Day in 1944.
Now you want me to?
Now, yeah, it's your turn.
You don't want me to answer any questions, just tell you about D-Day.
We'll have questions as we go along. All right, I'll start off with. You started coming in on the boats at the bottom of Pointe du Hoc. You've got a 10-meter-wide beach that really isn't a beach.
That's true. Not a beach, not in the sense of beach sand. It was stones, round stones, called shingles. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the so-called beach was very narrow at the foot of Pointe du Hoc, which are cliffs 100 feet tall, straight up. And we landed there D-Day morning. Supposedly, we're going to be there by 6:30. But we came off a channel steamer. You know, a channel steamer is a boat with cabins and everything on it. It goes from England to France and from France to England, just across the English Channel. But that was our transport of the Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really deluxe that we had rooms to ourselves, a couple guys to a room. We didn't expect such tender, loving care, but it was enjoyable. Anyway, it was manned by British seamen, British Navy men,
mm-hmm.
and they were the coxswains on our landing craft, and we were supposed to land at 6:30. However, the lead coxswain was lost. He was heading for the wrong point.
Mm.
He was. There are many points along the Omaha Beach areas, about 7 miles in width. And only one-third of it is a sandy beach where the troops landed on the sandy portion. The other two-thirds are cliffs all the way up to over 100 feet mm-hmm. as you proceed westwardly. So our commanding officer, he wasn't a general then, Colonel Rutter, mm-hmm. noticed this fact that we were seemingly headed for the wrong cliffs. And so he corrected the coxswain. Had him pull to the right and parallel the cliffs for several miles till we got up to Pointe du Hoc, which was several miles beyond the actual sandy beaches of Omaha Beach.
And all during that time, the Germans, of course, are shooting at you, I'm assuming.
No, yes, but had we been in on time, we'd have caught them in their quarters. This mm-hmm. is a very big group. This is a big fortress with underground railway, underground tunnels and things, and sleeping quarters, and where the German troops lived. But anyway, we would have caught them in their bed, and it would have been much easier. But because we were late by 30, 40 minutes, they were aroused by all the noise and shooting, because they didn't expect anybody to come up those cliffs. They had no defenses against that. They didn't think anybody was crazy enough to climb those 100-foot cliffs straight up. So their defenses were aimed in a different direction. But they came out and found that we were there, And so they kept shooting us off the ropes and shooting us down from the cliff tops, rolling boulders down and dropping grenades on us and doing everything they could to keep us from getting up there. However, we were very fortunate. We landed with 225 Rangers and 180 of us got up the cliff. Very quick time, managed to fight our way across the top of the point to where the big guns were supposed to be.
And what did you find when you found the supposed big guns?
I didn't find the guns were not where they were supposed to be. They were where our Army intelligence said they were, in these gigantic encasements. But when we got there, there was telephone poles sticking out of these encasements. And, you know, we had studied Point de Hoc from aerial photographs. Mm-hmm. And from the aerial photographs, they looked like the barrel of a gun sticking out a big howitzer or a ghost of a gun. But when we got to our gun positions we had been assigned to destroy them, and we found they weren't there, we figured, well, we'll fight our way inland because we had other parts of the mission. The second part of the mission was to get out to the coast road. That's about a mile inland, which is a coastal road between important sites. And we were to put up a roadblock to prevent the Germans from getting through to Utah Beach. And we then had to destroy all their communications along that highway, which we did. And when we got there, I landed with 22 men in my LCA, manned by British sailors. The 22 Rangers with me, by the time we fought our way through the Germans inland, I only had 12 left when I got to the road a mile inland, approximately. And while there, I told 10 of them, the section sergeants, to create a roadblock there while I asked one of the staff sergeants, my acting platoon sergeant. You see, we were in an acting capacity. Mm-hmm. I was an acting platoon leader, which is a position of a lieutenant. Jack Kuhn, my staff sergeant, he was acting in the role of a platoon sergeant, which is a tech sergeant. And so the 10 men that I left created the roadblock and took care of the communications, as was the second part of our mission, while Sergeant Kuhn, Jack Kuhn, and I went looking for some evidence of where the guns could probably or might be. We thought we'd hear them. Well, we didn't hear them. So we just had one choice, and people think we're heroes. I don't think we. We were at the right place at the right time and lucked out. We went down this sunken road between high hedgerows that are 9-10 feet high with trees 60 feet high out of the top of them. You could hide a whole column of tanks down this road because in back of those cliffs, the land dips down into the lowlands and flooded areas. So we leapfrogged down that road guarding each other. There's only two of us. We went beyond two lines of German defenses. It's 8 o'clock, before 8 o'clock in the morning. And they didn't dream that there'd be a couple American soldiers a mile or two inland or whatever it was. And so they didn't know we were there.
Okay. We're gonna take a break on that real quick, Len. Okay. And we'll be right back after this message. You're okay. Listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and Bob, you had a question for our guest.
Len, how are you this evening?
Fine, thank you.
Now, when you got to the top and you found that the guns weren't there, you actually had part of your mission accomplished. So to go inland and not just set up a perimeter there took a bit of initiative. Was that part of your training to take the initiative rather than defensive position?
We take charge. Our motto is to be the best of the best. We're all volunteers. But in any event, we went down that road and found the guns. They were very, very well camouflaged in an apple orchard. And they were at the ready with their ammunition all ready to be fired. But they weren't being fired for a reason. They weren't getting fire orders back from their observation point out on the cliffs of Point de Hoc, which was surrounded by E Company of our Ranger Battalion. And they had them bottled up that they couldn't get fire orders back to where Jack Kuhn and Sergeant Kuhn and I were. And so about 100 yards from us was 75 Germans. This is now 7:30, quarter to 8 in the morning. And they're off in this field getting at that time of the day, they were just getting up and coming in the various states of undress to this meeting they were having. And we were already behind the second line of defense. They didn't know we were there. So while they were busy engaged doing what they had to do, waiting for fire orders, and there was no one in the position, I asked Jack to get up on the high hedgerow there with his submachine gun and protect me as I would go into that gun position alone by myself and knock out as many guns as I could. Well, you know, having to climb those cliffs, we could only carry one incendiary grenade apiece. And we had to travel light so we could muscle ourselves up those cliffs. So he had one. He gave me his thermite grenade. I had one. And so I went in and I destroyed a traversing mechanism and elevation mechanisms with the thermite grenades of two of the guns of the five that were there. And I broke the sights on all of them by wrapping my field jacket around my butt of my submachine gun and smashing them. And none of this could be heard because of the manner in which we were trained to do these things. So then Jack and I decided we would run back just 100 yards to where our roadblock was and get as many grenades as we could carry back to come back and finish off the job. Well, it took about 10 minutes at most. And we came back and destroyed the other three, so all five were put out of action by 8 a.m. Now, that's early in the morning. And they contended that we were made the deepest penetration on D-Day morning. We were the first military outfit to accomplish its mission and finish it. We did it all by 8 o'clock in the morning, which, when you put out that kind of coastal gun positions, the biggest on the Atlantic coast, they said that we saved thousands, tens of thousands of lives on the beaches and on the ships. There's 5,000 ships out there moored, you know, with an invading force. And this is why the planners of the invasion were really so keyed up about having some way to ensure and guarantee those guns would be out of position, because there were hundreds and hundreds of planes that bombed it. There were thousands of shells from the two battleships of Texas and the Arkansas, and they all missed the targets. None of them destroyed any of the guns, and if it wasn't for us, the Rangers getting up those cliffs, finding them and destroying them, put them out of action, they would have been firing away uncontrollably, killing so many civilians and service people that they said it was in the thousands. So that's why it was so important. But again, I say, we were trained to do these things and
that was,
be resourceful and think and on our feet. We were lucky at the right time.
That was your job. And those guns had a range of, what was it, 25,000 meters? They could have taken out all of the ships
miles.
On Earth. Yeah,
fire 12 miles.
I think it's amazing. I should also point out to our listening audience that, I don't know, do you want to be called sergeant or lieutenant? Or just mister?
Pardon?
That you had been wounded on the initial assault.
Yes, I was the first one wounded in my company.
And you did all this while you were wounded?
I did it all with the wound. Listen, I got a luck out again. I caught a machine gun bullet through my right side where the muscle is. It didn't hit the hip joint.
I know, it didn't hit anything
hit any
important,
organ,
right?
So I could handle it.
As a result of your knocking out that artillery battery, you and Sergeant Kuhn were received medals for that.
Oh, yes.
And you got the Distinguished Service Cross, and
yes, I did.
Sergeant Kuhn got the Silver Star. I think that's incredible.
Yes, he did. He became Chief of Police of Altoona, Pennsylvania. He died here about a year or so ago.
Isn't it amazing when you look back at what you did when you were, 19, 20 years old?
I was 22. He may have been a little younger. I doubt it.
I think that the whole story is just amazing. And I congratulate you and thank you. for what you did to our service, to our country, and for our country at that time.
It happens, by the way, D-Day happens to be my 60th wedding anniversary.
That is very true.
A veteran, Veterans Radio salute to you and your wife.
Well,
what is her name?
Charlotte.
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 And I understand in reading your biography that she climbed Ponta Hawk also.
When we were 40 years old, I was in Paris on legal business.
That's right. And we're talking with Len Lamel of the 2nd Ranger Battalion, who was responsible for knocking out the artillery battery that was located on top of Ponta Hawk, climbing up a 100-foot cliff, finding the guns weren't there, went down the hedgerow, found the guns, threw some grenades in there, melt them down, went back and got more grenades.
Right.
What were the Germans doing? Were they watching you run around, or they just never saw you?
What were the Germans doing that we saw?
Yes.
They were gathering together in this field about 100 yards away. They didn't know there was any American soldiers that close to them. They never dreamed that we were in among them.
Couldn't they?
40 or 50 of a combat patrol of the Germans passed within 20 feet of Jack and I. There's only two of us, so we hid behind in a ditch behind a hedgerow. And fortunately for us, they didn't see us to detect us, or we'd have been dead. You have to have a lot of luck.
Oh no, I understand. Surviving conflict is always a matter of a lot of luck, but it's just amazing that you took the initiative to not only complete your mission, but to carry it all the way through with a lot of your buddies and commanders and everything falling by the wayside. I think that's just admirable, and it's something that American military has a history of doing that, and I think we all should be very proud of that.
Oh, well, we're very proud. We're very well trained, and if you're at the right place at the right time and you're trained to do something, you do it.
Well, I don't mean to gush on here, but I really do admire you. And I want to have you back on our program at some point, because I'd like to talk to you more about what happened once, post D-Day, because I know that you were evacuated 2 days after D-Day to get that minor wound taken care of.
Yeah, my side had turned black from gangrene.
You're just amazing. Well, I want to thank you, General Kaczynski, for being on Veterans Radio, and Len. Len Lamel, I want to thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. It's a great story, and there's much more to it, and we're going to have to have you back again to talk about this more.
You're Let's do a Ranger story.
I'm very proud to be on here.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank you very much.
You're the general for me.
I will.
Thanks, Len.
Okay.
Thank you both very much, and we'll be talking to you again soon. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Every once in a while, folks, we run into these incredible guests, and Bob found this because we were reading the information on Ponta Hawk, and we came across Stephen Ambrose's book, and he's talking about Len Lamel as being the one man who went up the cliff and blew up these artillery weapons, and then thanks to the general and to another old friend of ours, Charles Crone. Thank you very much, Charles. We do appreciate your help. We were able to get a hold of Len and talk to him personally. I just think that's amazing. What a story. And again, if it hadn't been for D-Day and for all those men and our fathers and grandfathers and so forth that fought in World War II, we wouldn't be here talking about them. And I want to make sure that we thank
it's
them.
It's such an American story, too.
It is.
I mean, it's an American story. The humility and bravery and just going on, pressing on.
Well, taking the initiative is always something that
and you didn't
the American
know
military.
What was ahead. You didn't know what was ahead.
No, there. Because as soon as everything was wrong. Okay, I just wanted to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. Remember, D-Day, June 1944, was the largest invasion in the history of the world. You heard about it on Veterans Radio. And until next week, you are dismissed.